shall we?
Sorry, Tim's not here.
As per last time, the effort here is to sort of step back and take a look at the
emergence of the human evolution as a storyteller. And there's a fair amount of background to this,
which I don't want to rehearse again.
And I don't even want to reduce this again, which basically is the outline of the state of the story of storytelling.
What I do want to do is to sort of update the story a bit and
talk about some new questions.
Update it from last week?
Yeah, or put it differently, I didn't get entirely to update last week.
Okay.
I want to
finish the update and then go on to what I think are new directions.
The update has been some talks and discussions not here, in some other arenas, of which one was called On Beyond Postmodernism, Discriminating Stories.
And it was a reaction to a lot of people's concerns that if everything was a story, that we were sort of stuck in outer space and we had no way to discriminate. And I gave a version of that talk here and then
extended it in the universe bar. The extension in the universe bar essentially was intended to say that
this problem of discriminating between stories is not only a problem significant in a scientific context. It's, of course, a quite general problem in culture. And so the effort was to talk about the process of story discrimination, both to reassure people that one could still discriminate stories in science, but also to use science as a model of the problem of story discrimination in culture in general.
Is that your son that you have to call you Dr. Krause?
Yeah. And Jed's quote was relevant because
some couple of years ago when I had, in another context, written about the notion that everything is story, Jed had said, in essence, look, you're beating a dead horse. Kids in my generation know that everything is story. What we need to know is not that everything is story. What we need to know is, what's next? So that's the beyond postmodernism connection.
So, I sort of laid out that much last week.
About it, which in turn led to some new questions, as these things always do and should. And here are the ones that I flagged off of our last conversation. Tim was particularly concerned about an issue of consistency in the storytelling story. He said that the storytelling story, in fact, denies the existence of a foundational starting point, but uses one. And if it was flawed in that logical sense, then one might say there's something wrong with this story. I don't think it is actually flawed in this logical sense. The story of storytelling actually has the seeds of destruction built into it. The argument is,
is that an oxymoron, seeds of destruction?
Interesting.
That's interesting.
That's a good one.
wrote in an earlier piece, whether there will be at some time in the future a singular outcome to science at this point, it will of course cease to be a singular activity is very much an open question, one that only time will answer, or I suspect fail to answer. The posture of science as storytelling is not that there is not a truth or reality. It is that one can't use those concepts as guides along the way. If, in fact, there is a truth or reality, the process of science as storytelling will indeed discover it.
I'm only bringing this up once, and you may not even have to address it, but this is exactly where I think you're going to lose most people, and you may not care, but I don't think the layperson is going to buy this at all. You're going to have no chance of selling this when you say something like that, or not. Well, all right, that's it.
No,
you know what I mean?
Said it, and I think it's important to have said it, because what I want to go on doing is, in the extensions, talk about how stories impact on particular audiences and what the implications of that are.
Just because I don't think this is, I hope that this conversation isn't limited to this room. I really hope not. And I really want to find a bridge there between people who should think about this, okay, and not. But you know what I mean? So I want you to maybe think about that.
No, I absolutely. I'll show you that I want to think about it.
Okay.
Well, I'm open to that. There is a question of audience. At any rate, I don't think the story is inconsistent in any destructive sense. I do think that the story uses a starting point. Indeed, one cannot not have a starting point. The issue about the story is not whether it has a starting point, but the degree to which it takes it as foundational, right, whether or not it's challengeable or modified. The validity of the starting point is always challengeable. That's not interesting. There is no starting point that cannot itself be challenging. What is significant is the usefulness of the starting point in its own context, i.e. what follows from it. It's generative. A second concern was Doug's. One test has been in the back of our collective mind is the Doug PA intelligent design trial for the false distinction used there to make a clear separation between these two stories. The answer is yes, and I walked through that in several contexts. It cannot, however, the normal, quote, traditional definition of science, I argued, cannot discriminate the two stories. But if you throw in generativity as a criteria, yes, you get a very clear distinction between the two. And that's how the case should have been argued in Dover, as far as I remember.
But we did talk about how you can define generativity.
There is an issue of definition of generativity on the table, yes.
So very clear might be overstated.
Fair enough. If we all live in a world where science can't be separated from non-science, then we may be entering another dark age. Also a concern of Doug's, which my response is quoted from another paper, both science itself and human culture, which in part would benefit from the story of science that encourages wider creative participation in the processes of scientific exploration.
That but I don't
need
think
to demarcate science from non-science. I am not, in fact, I would argue that a reluctance necessarily the market is a feature on the bucket. We actually want more flow between the two worlds, so I'm less concerned with the issue of whether a particular story provides a sharp demarcation.
Well, I think there's a difference between a flow between different kinds of stories or modes of thinking and being able to distinguish between them. And I would agree that if we can't distinguish between them, we've run into a lot of trouble.
That's
you know, there's this discussion going on that, you know, know, science should include non-natural phenomena, so that makes astrology just as good a science story as astronomy. And that's a problem in my book.
Let us indeed put both audience and issue of flow on the table as matters that need to be looked at more closely, and I propose to look at them more closely as we go along. For the moment, though, let me just remind you that alchemy was the origin of chemistry.
Yes, but we're not doing alchemy anymore.
I understand
well,
that.
Well, something might be headed back that way.
Well,
yes,
that good.
So the issue of demarcation is an interesting one.
Finally, there was this concern of ants, all hankerings are innately enabled by an articulate mechanism that evolved to protect our species from a kind of internal conflict that can trip up a thriving, procreating, and surviving fittest. The sense of it is that there really is a way to establish truth, as long as we think. If this actually happened, we would not have millions of people in psychiatric treatment. We would not have great conflicts between the Israelis and the Arabs, and everything would be fine.
Except we'd all be dead.
But it doesn't.
Okay, but let's just, that's a quote from a New York Times review article of this book on desire. I want, therefore I am. And my question was not, my question was, it seemed like this guy's description of an evolution to a point where all our hankerings are managed,
yes,
was, my question was, that seemed to be a very different story than yours, that it is our thinking or our rationalizing which creates the conflicts, and that the unconscious can settle those difficult questions,
yes,
with many variables that, you know, consciousness can't sort out. So it really was a question of where the conflicts are.
Yes.
To which
my point has been and will continue to be, were there no internal conflict, there would be no generativity.
Granted. But what that post was asking, if you read the whole thing, was where's the conflict and where is the resolving happening?
We take that question on exactly. Where's the conflict and where's the resolution? The other piece of background that I'd like to throw into this before doing what we're actually going to do today is Anthony Appiah was on campus for a month. He is a philosopher. Lectures he gave. Anybody else hear any more? Dan heard several of them.
Heard all.
Appiah was actually, at the end of the last lecture, the one that I heard, the student said, Professor Appiah, this is all very interesting. You sound a lot like a man named Richard Rorty, who was another philosopher. And can you position yourself relative to him? Happy, it was clearly a little uncomfortable with the question and referred sort of to a recent encounter that he had with Rorty. And Happy said, Rorty doesn't believe in the concept of truth. And I don't think we can, I don't think we have any basis for action without the concept of truth. We need truth and reality as an impetus. Furthermore, Appiah said, Rorty seems to think that imagination is at least as important as reason. And I'm not comfortable in that position. So Appiah is worried that he and others would
uncontrollably antisocial.
Passive?
Yes, passive. If we didn't have this search for truth, we would just sit there and not act. But on the other hand, and somewhat paradoxically, he's afraid that if we didn't have truth or reality, we would all become rage animals.
There's your conflict and potential resolution.
Yeah. Okay. So, this, in some sense, is the set of challenges with the ones we've just listed. And what I want to do is to continue the story off those challenges, or in relation to those challenges. And what I want to do is, rather than arguing about any of the starting points, I want to do what a mathematician does. What a mathematician actually does, or at least what the mathematicians have done since the late 1800s, is to recognize that one always uses starting point. The interesting question for a mathematician is, what can you infer from a given set of starting points? That is, in some sense, what a mathematician is interested in is the generativity of a particular set of starting points, not the legitimacy of a particular set of starting points. And the best example of this was the ability of mathematicians in the late 1800s to say, look, there's an interesting characteristic to Euclidean geometry. It is a systematization that starts from a fixed set of starting points. Among the fixed set of starting points, there is only one line parallel to any given line. The mathematicians said, hey, let's look to see what happens if we change that starting point. Nobody said, you can't use a different starting point. Mathematicians realized you could use any goddamn starting point you want. The issue is what results from it. And so what I want to do is to ask the question, I want to give up now all arguments about starting points. I want to focus attention on what the starting points are, what the consequences of those are, and how generative the thing is. All right, so we're going to look at this thing the way a mathematician. What are the starting points? Well, the first starting point is humans are the product of an undirected evolutionary process. And that, of course, is a starting point that is interesting to us. A second starting point is humans have the capacity to make meaning out of processes which themselves lack meaning.
I don't know what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is precisely storytelling. What I mean by that is we see pattern, we notice pattern, we give pattern meaning. It has no meaning without us giving it to it. There is
so
no
I do,
intrinsic meaning.
And you make up a story that I really hate. Or you make up a story that I have Tourette's and I can't control.
Whatever.
So you
and
make a story out of the activity.
Right. And I'll show you some places where this is directly relevant to biology.
This is actually related to developmental robotics. So that the idea is that how can you take a bunch of sensor readings and go to some kind of understanding of environment. So, and you don't even know what your sensors are, and you don't even know how your that you have motors.
Yep.
So I think that's.
So is a corollary of this quasi-axiom that there are no such things as processes that do have meaning?
Yes.
We give them the meaning.
It doesn't
sure
say anything
I'm
about
comfortable with that, but
it doesn't say anything about information, Karen. It just says remove from the
and I actually think that was the argument in my paper. that the world is random and unpredictable.
No, be careful. I didn't say the world is random. I didn't say it's unpredictable. But you can't do that. The assertion that it does not have meaning is not an assertion that there it is random, that there is not predictability. It's not any of that. It's simply saying
if it were random.
That's exactly correct.
I think you're going to get
what?
You couldn't get meaning if the world were random. If there weren't patterns in the world, you wouldn't be able to build something on that.
That's stable.
No, I just feel like we're back in the, you know, if the tree falls in the forest.
We're exactly with the tree falling in the forest, and the answer to the tree falling in the forest is, as far as we know, this is another set of issues, a tree falling in a forest does produce disturbances in the air. No question about it. But the sound requires an observer there, and the sound differs depending on the observer. Therefore, the sound doesn't occur in the absence of the observer. It's exactly the same argument.
Well, but what if a bird hears it?
What the bird hears is a sound. It's not the same sound that I would hear or that a bat would hear.
Well, I think that's a terribly narrow vision.
It may be, but let's find out whether it's useful. That's the issue. All that this is saying is not that there is order or pattern or predictability outside of humans. It's saying only that the significance attributed to the pattern or regularity is provided by the detector of the pattern or regularity and might be different if it was provided by some other detector.
But the detecting of the pattern is itself a story.
I don't want to do that yet. Okay.
I think this all applies to even your first point. I think, again, you're going to get confusion when if people see undirected, and I think the same clarification needs to be applied right away, right there, to make sure that everybody is on the same page. Don't let them freak out about it's randomness and meaningless. Say undirected doesn't mean there's not a pattern to it.
Yes.
Okay. I think the same thing applies
to that. Yes, absolutely.
Well, wherever you're going with this, you shouldn't call this an axiomatization. There are no axioms in what you're saying.
No, there are. But what I'm doing is I'm calling these axioms, and I'm going to derive things from them.
Mathematicians would be jumping on you.
I understand. That's fine. I'm calling them axioms because I don't particularly want to defend them. I want to ask what the implications
are. There you go.
I love that.
Isn't that what a mathematician would do with that?
That's what an expert mathematician
does.
No, no mathematician, says, I am going to defend the proposition that there are an infinite number of lines parallel to a given one.
That's not what it is. Axioms are made up of a finite set of well-defined symbols.
Yes, and that part of it I'm not worried about.
That's why you don't have an axiomatization here. What you have is the basis of what you might want to call an argument, that's as far as you want to go.
That's
about.
Premise.
You don't want to get
if you like, you'd rather call them premises, it's fine. Third one, since humans are making meaning out of processes that don't have it, they can't ever know that they are right. They can only bet on particular meanings and see what happens. Their bipartite brains have evolved facilitate this process, one that depends fundamentally on both rationality and imagination.
Can you say, I mean, I'm thinking now about Will's challenge that you want to make this argument as widely
digestible
as possible.
And meaningful.
Could you say humans are making meaning out of processes that may or may not have any? In other words, can't ever know if we're right.
Yeah, sure.
Because there's something about a line drawing in the sand there.
Sure.
The processes don't have meaning.
Sure.
I guess I'm still really, really uncomfortable that
this set of premises is entirely anthropocentric.
Okay, again,
stated.
I don't want to defend the set of premises. I want to know what happened.
I just feel like we're heading back to Humpty Dumpty again, who said, you know, the it means whatever I say it means, and I don't, you know, who cares what anybody else
that
thinks.
That was Humpty Dumpty who said that.
Well, word means whatever I want it to mean.
That was
Humpty Dumpty.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's glory for
yeah.
you. That's a fine knockdown, drag out argument.
I wouldn't say it's anthro. Post-centric. I would say it's censor post-centric. So the censor.
Well, but the premises are all saying humans do this and humans
yeah,
do that.
Okay.
And I'm just bothered by that because it denies that there is a
robot right by humans.
There are
I
processes that don't involve us.
It does not deny it. And exactly what. What follows from these premises is what I want to get to. The argument I want to make is, rather than worrying about the premises and what they lead to, we should have the premises clearly stated, and then we can see what they lead to. And in fact, they do not lead to the conclusion that there are no processes that don't involve humans at all.
Unfortunately, another thing you have here is a blurring of what imagination and rationality are. But just by the way you're stating it, it's not clear that there's a difference. If there is no reality and you're making a bet, then rationality and imagination really are blurring to me there. I don't see the cut.
We make a distinction in AI between exploration and exploitation. So you exploit what you know in a rational sense. And you explore, in a sense, in a random way. So you can think of that as imagination, just trying things.
But it's all a bet anyway. So what's the real difference between those?
Well, in AI, it's a trade-off between, you know, finding things that you would have never found if you just stayed on the rational path.
Yep. I can see maybe the extremes there, but.
Yep. Doug's distinction is exactly the one in mind here.
Okay.
The consequence of all of this is there shall be no appeal to truth or reality, not even masquerading as successive approximations. These starting points, I now assert, logically, do not eliminate impetus. They do not preclude rationality. They do not unshackle the beast, nor do they preclude discrimination. They do, however, allow for agent discriminations in truly unknown circumstances and learning from them.
And if someone says, as Cheryl Shen said in one of the seminars with Appiah, if there isn't a truth, there's no reason for me to go on searching.
I'm denying that that is a direct, it's a fear that these principles lead in that direction. I'm denying that they lead in that direction.
So for individuals, they might?
I don't think they necessarily do. I don't think they logically do.
But again, I think the issue that Will raised about appealing to the broader audience is a very significant one.
We're on our way there.
Right.
One can and should still make discrimination based on past projected grid or generativity. With the understanding now that this is always a bet. It's never certain. Storytelling doesn't actually threaten agency, the sense of being in control of oneself, the sense of an agent oneself. It actually is the foundation of agency. Without the storytelling phenomenon, there would be no agency.
That seems existential. I mean, that's amazing.
The whole thing
it's
is
obvious.
To feel
so some people want
existential.
God to give them their agency and instill and freak out when you say undirected. And then the rest of us who went over the existential abyss say it's the only way to define yourself is through action and agency. So we still need to meet somewhere.
Okay. So, as far as I'm concerned, this says logically a lot about what people are afraid happens if you start with those premises.
Yeah.
And I'm saying logically none of that happens. Given that none of that happens.
Hold on 1 minute. But emotionally, if it happens?
Emotionally, if it happens.
You can still learn to make it happen different.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing, I think.
Because I think people will say, well, logically maybe, but I have to have truth or I'm just going to curl up and die.
Yeah. So, what I now want to do is I want to ask of this story what I think is the really interesting question, and that is, how generative is it? So I want to try evaluating this story at the present time in its own terms. How generative is it? How broad is the story? What was I trying to make sense of? And the argument going to be that I was trying to make sense of a very large array of things. And what's it relevant to? How useful is it? So let's start with biology. These are the notes from Bio 103 class I'm teaching. And this yellow post-it up here is actually a response to posting by a student in the forum, prompted by the question, how significant is it to know about macromolecules of your student life?
They didn't want to reduce.
I just put the question. I just put the
question.
How significant is what we have learned about macromolecules of your student life? And the response from the student was, in essence, you learn a certain number of things by studying macromolecules, but the discussion of lower levels cannot overshadow the bigger picture. And bingo, I started thinking, of course molecules are important, of course they do affect the bigger picture, but they in turn are influenced by and derive significance from the bigger picture they're a part of. We tend to teach in a biology course that DNA is the blueprint of life. It's not the blueprint of life. It's just flat out not. A DNA molecule by itself can do absolutely nothing at all. It has no meaning. It has no significance. The DNA molecule has significance only in the context of a bunch of other molecules around it. And it has meaning only insofar as we as investigators give it that meaning. Interestingly, the same thing applies to genes, and the same thing applies to individuals, and as I've argued, the same thing applies to stories. At all levels, there is a context dependence in which significance is not inherent in the things themselves. Significance has to do with their interaction with other things, and meaning is given to them by point, the storytelling point, context dependence, is directly relevant with biology.
That little yellow box, by the way, I think sort of sums up my lifelong goals. Would it be to make a piece of software that has those properties?
Absolutely. I guess my issue, Paul, is that
people's life
Frank,
goals.
The significance of components of living things. I don't have any trouble with dealing with the context, but if we took away the human interpretation of meaning, the organism would chug along perfectly
Absolutely.
Happily without us.
Absolutely.
So
one of my reactions is, I don't see any real need to put the philosophical overpinning on top of it.
That's exactly the issue. And in fact, what I'm going to try and show you is the philosophical overpinning on top of it allows for porosity or bridges to other things which are actually relevant. It's a way of finding a language that can be used commonly in a whole bunch of different contexts, and hence facilitates exchange between isolated areas of inquiry. So yes, I agree with you. I do not need the philosophy in the biology. That the philosophy is relevant in the biology provides a way to bridge areas of inquiry. Yep.
Point you sound like an emergence all of a sudden, Karen. That sounds like everything's emergent then.
No, not everything is emergent.
It happens without us, or?
Well, it does.
All right, that's right. That's not the same. Okay.
Let's look at some other things, and then we'll come back to this. Because it's at the core of the problem. The core of the problem is that aspects of a story may or may not be relevant in particular contexts. The story may nonetheless be useful in a whole array of contexts. And because it's useful in a whole array of contexts, it provides the way for exchange across contexts that are normally isolated from one another, an exchange that can become productive. So, a quick dip in the bottom. The other issues that were on my mind as the story evolved actually had to do with psychology and some problems having to do with the relationship between neurology, psychiatry, and an older tradition of psychoanalysis. And I won't go through the details there, but to a very large extent, the storytelling conception arose because I, as a neurobiologist, knew that I did not have, in my vocabulary, things that would allow me to talk to psychoanalysts. And I needed to. There's also social psychoanalysis, bred influences. The effort was to also understand various examples of conflict between human beings. And again, I'm not going to go into the details of that right now, but it's what led to an interaction between me and Tim about the issue of agency. And it led to a number of subsequent things in which the storyteller notion turns out to be very useful for understanding and posing new questions about social organization. So the breadth was there in the enterprise, even if I didn't recognize it. It was actually an effort to come up with a characterization that would be useful in a wide array of contexts.
Can you address at this point the question I was asking and I posed it in terms of where the conflict is located?
Yes.
Whether it's the product of thinking and
yes.
trying to organize stuff, whether it's a product of a disjunct between consciousness and unconscious,
yes.
whether it has to do with
yes.
multiple conflicting stories in the
yes.
unconscious.
Yes. But I won't do it right now. Let me go one step further. What I actually wanted to report on today is some further extensions of this that have happened in the last several months. One of them is this exhibit came about because of Ohio State, the Master of Fine Arts program, said, I've just read your article, Making the Unconscious Conscious, come to the conclusion that you are the perfect person for me to ask what I fear will be a very naive question. I've been banging my head against the wall. The question, do we, by we, I mean scientists, a term I'm using ridiculously broadly, to know how the unconscious makes things happen? In other words, most simply put, when we, for example, leave a jacket behind by accident because we want to make sure we have a chance to return to the place we've been without being aware that all we've done so, how does that unconscious impulse create a metaphor of the left behind jacket?
what's the link between the impulse? Tell you the truth, somebody's in their life writing fiction. I can't believe I've never wondered before. And now I'm deeply shocked that I've never wondered. I'm wondering whether, it seems likely, there are theories about this process that I don't know about. It's too big a question, too small a question, a smart one, or incredibly dumb one. And why can't it? I won't go through the details of this either, but what's here is a set of exchanges between me and Herman. And the set of exchanges fundamentally hangs on the concept of storytelling.
Sounds like a conversation between Neo and Morpheus.
And it turns out the conversation is in fact productive, not only for her, but also for me. The conversation actually forced me to make more explicit that there is not only a storyteller and an unconscious, there is an essential dynamic in the interactions between them. And that the essential dynamic has the result that one may exhibit a behavior that makes sense only in terms of a story without oneself knowing what the story is. That has to be a property of interaction between the storyteller and the unconscious.
Wasn't that that's the consciousness interacting with emotional unconsciousness?
Yes, to a significant extent, if you like.
Or at least that's where it exceeded in my mind.
And this bears closely on a problem that we've discussed in this group before, several times, and that is whether you can account for things in terms of two systems, or whether you need three. The real problem in accounting for them with two has always been there is this phenomenon of people exhibiting behaviors that make sense in terms of a story, and they don't know what the hell the story is. So, there's a significant extension of the storytelling story here, which itself resulted from the fact that the storytelling story spoke to somebody who was themselves interested in the storytelling and who would not have been engaged with but for the storytelling.
So the unconscious is story making?
No.
So what is the story? If someone is exhibiting behavior that makes sense in terms of a story and they don't know what the story is, where's the story?
I see that as the pattern that you're talking about without the meaning yet.
What's argued in here, and essentially the notion is there is an ongoing, continual negotiation
right.
between the unconscious and the storyteller. In the course of that negotiation, there may be stories tried out which are impacting on the unconscious. But since that's still in the negotiation process, those transient stories are not things that come to consciousness. They are not experienced. They're part of the negotiation process. So they may show up in the output without in fact becoming conscious experience.
But this is distinct from behaviors which like reflex behaviors.
Absolutely.
And things like that.
Absolutely. This is a third category of behavior. And it's the one that psychoanalysts have been worrying about for years.
That's a really good
So I
point
can
here.
Give
That's
a neurobiological
point.
Qu-
quasi-neurobiological explanation of a class of behaviors which neurobiologists in general won't talk about, which are the only behaviors interesting to psychoanalysts, is a bridge now possible. It wasn't there before.
Now, would you agree with this essential, my essential, just to help me clarify this, that I've heard you say that the brain has all kinds of activity on its own, right?
Yep.
So, I mean, is it correct to interpret this, as I just said, that there's a pattern, you know, called emotional or unconscious or whatever, that we just don't have meaning for yet, but our storyteller tries to.
Absolutely.
All the time.
That's exactly correct.
And yeah, and then but then the reflex thing now comes in. No, there's some that just bypass that altogether. Do you think maybe?
I'm trying to think of an example, like love.
No, love is too simple.
Just some people.
Her example. Love. Her example is actually a wonderful one. Her example was actually she tells an even more wonderful one. There's an excerpt from her essay on here, and the story she tells is a story of her daughter. Will you let me do one thing, and then we'll come
okay.
back to this?
Yeah.
I want to just, since this is the last time I'm going to talk about this, I just want one more thing on the table,
right.
Then I'll come back to this. The other thing I want on the table is a still more recent thing on serendipity. It's called The Art Historian and the Neurobiologist. And again, it results from an inquiry. The inquiry in this case, I read a paper by one of your students entitled The Eye Function. Where's the person? The article is pretty intriguing. I've been trying to write a paper about a performance artist, and I think this is directly relevant. Can you tell me any more about the eye function? I write back to her, I say, thanks for your interest. The eye function is actually a term that I coined. You're not going to find it anyplace else. I'm glad you like it, but, I say, over recent years, I've stopped using it. I'm using instead the word storyteller. And here's the logic, and so forth. Maybe you'll like storyteller even better. There's a whole exchange with her here, which she writes back and says, I hate storyteller. I want eye function. Don't do it. This is context. This is audience. Something that works for one doesn't work for the other.
Essentially, it's the same thing to you, though.
No. Because once she had come back to me and said, look, let me show you why I like eye function and I don't like storytelling, what it turns out results from that, again, goes back to something earlier in this group. Storyteller is a more general term. It includes eye function. But there are a bunch of other things in the storyteller, like layers of onions. Eye function, as it was originally conceived, is actually the innermost layer of an onion, which is the storyteller. Which I should have thought about before, but didn't. But at any rate, the bridge has been useful to me as it's been useful to her. It really is. There really are audience events. The critical question about the story is not whether there are audience events, but the amount of give there is in the story to adapt it for audience events. In this case, the interaction clearly was generative for both her and me, and it taught me something about my own story. But on a broader scale, what it actually says is another way to think about whether stories are good stories is how much flexibility they have, how much give they have, how adjustable they are for audience effects.
And that's different than generativity.
Yes. Or, no, it's a contribution to generativity. My guess is more brittle stories, on the whole, will be less generative than more pliable stories. Bottom line. The story of storytelling got started because of an effort not to solve a single problem, but rather to solve what unconsciously I felt to be the same problem in a large number of fields. The justification for a story like this is not its starting points, not its feared outcome, but rather how useful it is over how wide an array of contexts. At this point, this story is looking good to me.
Well,
but let me go one step further. With another line of evidence, maybe there actually is a bear there. 2 weeks ago, I got an email from a geology professor, at young geology professor, assistant professor at Brigham Young University, sending me a manuscript called Science of Storytelling that he and a philosopher colleague at Brigham Young have just written for use in this guy's introductory geology course. He feels it to have a way to begin his teaching of science.
At Brigham Young University, that's not going to be a
with something other than what he's been using, and an article called Science of Storytelling resulted from it.
Well,
and, amusingly, if you Google, not on storytelling, two words, which is the way I do it, but on storytelling, one word, lo and behold, storytelling scientist's perspective, John C.
You've been duped. How do you feel about that?
An interesting notion. One certainly that there is something useful about a story that it's generated can actually be enhanced by having other people get to the same place along quite different paths.
I think it was the
same. I would say if a biologist gets there along one path, a geologist gets there along a different path, and a computer scientist gets there along a third path.
It must be wrong.
There is probably.
It must be true. Oh. That's where he's going.
There is.
What is this? There must be a there. Isn't that
there.
Truth?
Isn't
that truth?
Collectively
huh?
validated?
Huh?
Isn't that just collectively
in Gertrude
validated?
Stein's immortal words, probably a there.
Well, Paul, I guess I'm still very uncomfortable because the examples that you give and the interactions that you've had when we're talking about audience, when we're talking about making this intelligible and comfortable, your intellectual audience so far has been a very lofty one. And you take the average person on the street with a high school education and they're not going to understand squat.
No, it's not true, because I do this with K-12 teachers every
Sunday.
Well, I would argue that you guys didn't get there on different lines. I argue that you guys addressed the emotional reaction that you knew was going to come from this first. And it was what worked really well in the K-12, is you said, let's talk about flat earth first. Let's talk about the emotional response I know you're going to have. And let's try to just say, let's suspend the emotion, and let's just have a conversation between reason and emotion and see what evolution is all about. They approached evolution a lot more openly once you addressed, you knew what emotions you were going to bring. So when you addressed that first, and I think this guy from Brigham Young was like, oh my God, I'm going to have all these young Earth people, and I got to tell the story, and I just have to address their emotion in response first before I can even get into the science behind it. And I would say that that's the same. furthermore, you there's not a there there. I think there's an approximation you both arrived at.
Oh.
Don't overstate your case.
I think it's hilarious that you start by saying there's no truth and you end by saying there's a there.
No,
there.
I do not.
That's very...
The only definition of a there, admissible, Eastern, is the commonality of stuff. That's all there means.
Well, it has to have these predictable characteristics,
yeah.
Scientific method,
yeah.